This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, on the heels of last week's midterm election, a discussion about democracy and extreme partisanship. Speaking later in the program will be Natalie Jomini-Stroud, Associate Professor of Communication Studies and Assistant Director of the Annette Strauss Institute for Civic Participation at the University of Texas at Austin. She has researched and written about how the media affect our political behaviors and attitudes, and how our political behaviors and attitudes affect our media use. But first, Scott Stroud, also an associate professor at the University of Texas, researches and lectures on the intersection between rhetoric, philosophy, and the work of famed philosopher John Dewey, and the connection linking artful communication and democracy, as explicated by the American pragmatists. Stroud's talk is timely as he spoke about what he calls partisan perfect reasoning and how we might rethink our political attitudes and behaviors in order to achieve greater mutual respect and civility between people with different political views.
So first, let's ask that question. What is democracy? You know, this seems like a simple question. You say, well, it's what we did on Tuesday. What is democracy? It means you have a certain button that popped up on your Facebook feed when you voted. Okay, and that's typically how we conceptualize democracy, right? A political decision-making procedure. So probably if I ask you what's democracy, you'd say, it's voting, or it's voting for people who will later vote in Congress to make decisions that need to be made, pass this law, not pass this law, give money to certain agencies, etc. Okay, so this is kind of a standard notion of democracy. It's a way to make decisions in certain rarefied instances. For you and I as voters, that's probably every few years, every 4 years for the president, etc. Right? It's not something you do every day on this notion of democracy. Now, this has always struck me as kind of a not the most helpful way of thinking about what democracy is, right? Because what does it do to you? You will quickly get painted into the corner that if my power in democracy happens every X number of years when I vote, and there's a bunch of people, I'm bad at math, remember, a bunch of people in the U.S. voting, that means my say in a democracy is one infinitesimally small selection of that pizza pie of the number of total voters. Okay, so you know, this kind of is depressing. Democracy becomes something sporadically done, and when it's done, I don't have much of a say in it. So this is what got me early on when I started reading folks like John Dewey. Because John Dewey has a weird way of, one, being verbose, but two, putting things in a new light. So early, when he was a young, newly minted assistant professor in 1888, this is young Dewey with a cool mustache, always a constant with Dewey. You know, he wrote something like this in one of his first articles criticizing a political scientist named Henry Maine, who said, democracy stinks because it splits up the power of sovereignty into all these little voters who have no say in the whole matter of it. And Dewey said, you know, this is fundamentally wrong. Democracy isn't just decision-making. Look at the last part of this quotation. Democracy is a form of government only because it's a form of spiritual or moral association. How people relate to each other. You know, and people relate to each other a lot more often than just once every so many years when they vote, right? A lot of times when you vote, you don't even talk to people. You're silent in a line, like you're going to break some election rule, get up there and flip the Diebold machine. You know, it's a very non-social event of voting usually. Even the caucuses. I was bummed when Texas had the caucuses because I was all ready to go with the, after we did the voting in the morning, go to the caucus later on to talk things out. No, you just sit on one side of the church pews in the Church of Democracy and they count up for this candidate or that. So there's no talking. So association. That's weird. Now look, fast forward here. Dewey lived a long time. On the eve of his 80th birthday, he pens these words. And the part of the quotation that's very interesting is this last part where he says, you know, don't think of democracy as external action. Think of it as something internal. Now, what is that? Well, you know, we're only going to really get the meaning when we realize in thought and action that democracy is a personal way of individual life, that it signifies the possession and continual use of certain attitudes, forming personal character and determining desire and purpose in all the relations of life. You look at the top line of this quotation, democracy is a way of life. Now, that's what I want to advance to you today, is a neat way of looking at what we mean with democracy and how our communication practices can go right or wrong in terms of democracy and enabling it in the future. It's a way of life. Now, you know, some of you are probably like, oh my gosh, do I have to take a lot of votes all through my life? Again, get out of the mindset that democracy is just a way of taking votes, sporadic instances. It's a way of continually associating with people. So in our pragmatist vocab, you say something like this. Democracy is not just a decision-making procedure, who you elect and what they do when they do it. It's a way that you, I, representatives, senators, presidents, interact with people. And like everything humans do, this is subject to becoming habitualized. So the question is, what kind of habits of interaction do we have with other people? are these habits constructive or are they destructive? Okay. Put it in rhetoric, you know, because that's a cool word I like throwing around. Who knows exactly what it means? But the way I cash it out, what rhetoric is really getting at is the way we interact with other people. And what do you do when you interact with other people? You advance certain messages. You try to make meaning in light of how they receive that meaning. You try to persuade them to do one thing over another. And the other side to rhetoric is when they do the same to you, how do you accept or reject or ignore or pay attention to these kind of messages they're advancing? This happens in public speaking. It happens when Spielberg makes a movie, etc. So, you know, this is what I really think is happening when we talk about democracy and rhetoric and the habits. What kind of citizens do we have that are making messages, you know, in political context? Okay, we all have our favorite obnoxious signs. I cannot believe someone would accuse Rahm Emanuel of liking Nickelback. They're Canadian. Okay, he's American. But, you know, think of how we form our protest messages. You know, what they say about us and what they say about the other person. This is, you know, I think, kind of the bedrock, the hard pan of democracy, how we conceive of all the people in the interactions we're going through. So let's talk about this in terms of what threatens democracy. You know, because, you know, you want democracy to flourish, you worry about what brings it down. Now, I just got back a month ago from a country I'm falling more and more in love with, India. It's chaotic. I think the slogan for India should be, India, somehow it works. You know, because you'll see people, mopeds with like five people on it, but they're safe somehow in the chaotic traffic. But India is the largest democracy in the world, but by no means is it the best functioning democracy in the world. And there you still have what I'd consider very real external threats to democracy. Literally one mayoral race in the last election had a debate, and the debate was settled or ended by someone in the audience setting themselves on fire and tackling, I guess, the person they didn't like in the debate. Okay? You know, so you get awful uses of force that we don't have here. You have real corruption. Everyone's for purchase. At least this is my impression of Indian politics and law enforcement and such. You know, you got big money in the U.S. We worry about unions, corporations, millionaires, etc. No academics, so we don't have money, so we're not going to throw around our script that much. But, you know, we're not worried so much about that. And even if we are, right, even if we reform filibuster laws, voting laws, to get everyone out there to the ballot box, you still have the question of what kind of habits do these people that are now taking part in politics or not taking part in politics, what kind of habits of interaction do they have? So I submit to you that the real threat to democracy, even after you fine-tune the system, get corruption out of there, get coercive force out of there, you're still going to have the question of what kind of habits do people have that are taking part in the system, taking part in the system beyond just voting, too, right? Because voting's sporadic, episodic, it doesn't happen a lot. But every day we're interacting with people. So how is that democratic way of life being threatened or furthered? So that's what I want to focus on, the internal threats to democracy. Now the one I want to focus on is going to be obviously connected to partisanship. But let's back up a second. What's the kind of the big challenge here with you and me trying to be these ideal democratic citizens we ought to be, right? Now democracy is characterized by some level of hopeful participation of you and me in politics. That's what makes it different from totalitarian regimes, oligarchy, et cetera, right? We're supposed to be taking part in this. Now, what happens when we take part in this? Well, you know, it's going to be solving problems with other people, people that don't always agree. Okay, that's going to be the key to communications entry into democracy. So the way I boil this down, I'm a simple-minded thinker, so I like to think that in simple ways. What do we do when we take part in democracy? It's going to be kind of we're walking the razor's edge between assertiveness and openness to other people. You know, this is what happens in any communicative situation, right? You have some view of the world. I'm a Phillies fan, so it wasn't a fun year for me. You know, so I want to say, my team has the best bullpen in the league. So I advance some kind of claim, and then you come back and say, well, it didn't matter. You react to that. Now, ideally, right, you're open. You know, let me hear him out, and then maybe I'll adopt this position. Okay, you know, then you could assert something in response, and there's kind of this is the negotiation, the dialectical dance of communication, argument, rhetoric. Okay, so what I'm going to say is that the challenge of democracy, right, is forming folks that have the right balance between assertiveness and openness. If you're too open, you're just going to be a listener, you're going to be a follower. You probably know people in your everyday life like this. You say, hey, let's go skate, you know, and then they go skate. Let's go do this, or, you know, they go whichever way the wind blows. Then you probably know people that are too headstrong. They have one way, theirs. Okay, you know, and so the ideal communicators are going to be folks that are going to be able to be open and change when it's necessary and useful, but also speak up for themselves and their interests. So now, how do we hit that kind of balance? How can we be truly open and assertive communicators without just closing down one or the other? Especially in the era of internet argument, right? Where it seems to be the people that can be loudest are correlated in their minds with being the rightest or the most true or the most good. So how do we walk that balance in today's communication scenario? This is a question that increasingly interests me. Okay, I'm going to go over three paths. The first path to addressing this challenge of how do we balance openness to someone else's viewpoint and assertiveness of what we take to be the ideal viewpoint. One's going to be the path of partisanship. One's going to be the path of skepticism or the skeptic. And the last one will be the path of the pluralist. The last two paths, I'm not going to go over that as much because, you know, finite time and bad arguments. I got to make choices. But I'll focus more on the first one, you see, because this is a track that the other Dr. Stroud and myself are proceeding down in parallel fashion. I come at things from the pragmatists, Jain philosophy and religion in India, Kant with my new book. She comes at it from social scientists. But I think we're still kind of pointing at some of the same problematic habits and things we want to reform. So the first path, how do you deal with, this? Well, you know, the partisan, let's leave aside that side term, but maybe you and I, we'd say, you're open until you identify the right thing to believe or the right thing to say. And then you defend it. You push it on people. Someone else has a different view of things. Well, that's a pretender. That's an illusory account that says it's true, but I've already identified the true thing, so let me just push that forward and, you know, maybe hit you over the head with some argumentative clubs or something, get you to buy this. You know, this is, I submit to you, is kind of the model path of the partisan. Identify the true or the good, you know, and then defend it. Don't give it up easily because you've already identified what you need to identify. Now, the problem with this sounds cool, right? This is what we teach in critical thinking or logic or informal argument classes. You know, you sort through the chaff, find the wheat, you know, and then you defend it. Problem with that, of course, is that humans, you know, as social scientists, are increasingly telling us, they're very good at thinking they're being open to other points of view, but what they're really doing is just defending to the death the view they were antecedently priorly committed to. Okay, this is what I'm going to call partisan reasoning. The idea that, you know, I believe this and so it must be true. And that's fundamentally different than saying I'm open to being basically wrong about what I just took a second ago to be certainly true. So this is what the path of the partisan is about. Identify the thing that you think is true, but you already had it. You already knew you were a Democrat or Republican, and then defend it to the death against those enemies over there. So like for a test of this, let's look at this passage from Tom Allen. I believe he was a Democrat from Maine. He has this nice book, Dangerous Convictions. Look at this passage. Democrats see Republicans as inattentive to evidence and expertise, unconcerned about Americans struggling to get by, and reflexively opposed to government action to deal with our collective challenges. On the other hand, Republicans see Democrats as the party of a government that routinely infringes on personal freedom, as creators of a culture of dependency among people who should stand on their own, and as promoters of change from traditional values that are going to leave us weaker than before. Now, think about your reaction to this. We don't have time to, you know, get you to share your feelings with me, but chances are, if you're like many Americans, you're going to say, yeah, that part is right, accurate, based on fact. That other part, oh my gosh. Someone's been listening too much to Rachel Maddow or Glenn Beck or whatever. You know, this is the typical partisan reaction, right? Is that one side grasps onto reality and that other side, oh, that's a gross distortion of anything resembling reasonable, fact-based argument. Okay? So this is the partisan mindset. And what's interesting, right, is the person right next to you or over here, maybe these are all the mean people and nice people, I don't know how you divide up in here, but there's someone else in this room that thought just the opposite of you. That other part was the accurate one. That's a caricature of what we should be saying about Democrats or Republicans. That's the partisan reaction, you see. That's what I'm going to call the antinomy. This is a Kantian term. I just like using that to torture students and other people with Kantian craziness. But, you know, Kant talked about antinomies, where there are two arguments for both sides of two opposing issues. And it seems like we're now in a quandary. So think of this as what you can call the antinomy or the quandary of partisan reasoning. And this is something you probably all feel, right? So many times in life, I think I'm right. You know, I looked at the evidence, I looked at the arguments. Yeah, I know why I hold this view. It wasn't just random. I didn't just wake up today and say, I'll be a Republican, or I'll be a Democrat, I'll be a feminist, I'll be a men's rights activist, you know, whatever, you know, ism you want to subscribe to. Okay, you know, so there are reasons. You see the reasons, you see the truth, you see why you hold that, not something else. So, you know, you're going to, darn it, we're going to stick to that. We're going to be a little consistent. On the other hand, Anyone that's gone to college, right? That's one neat thing about college. You see a diversity of smart and stupid ways of thinking all over the world, okay? So, you know, and the things that's stupid, right? You know, typically other people are the ones that are stupid, right? You know, myths or other people's religion. So this is a human tendency. We love this feeling of certainty we have, and we think we see the reasons that transcend mere feelings, why we believe that way. But then if you really take a second and step back, you see how the person right next to you thinks differently, but thinks in a similar way with that feeling business of certainty. This is the problem with partisan reasoning. We all think differently, yet we all think we've got hold of the truth. So notice here, my use of partisanship, I'm not using this in a simple sense of who you vote for every 4 years on the Diebold machine. What I'm using this for is more, a habitual starting point to how we reason and think through decisions. Decisions of who to vote for, perhaps. Decisions of how to talk to someone else. Okay, so, think of these kind of senses as a party. You know, you have a collection of beliefs you've uttered, defended, come to in previous experience in your life. You know, you don't just give them up. So there's a sense where the I of yesterday kind of constrains the I of today. And I don't want to, evince treason to that self, those collections of beliefs. The feminist me, the men's rights activist me, the Democrat me, the Republican me, whatever that kind of, group of beliefs is defined as. And then there's the standard version of parties, I'm a feminist, so this means I believe certain subordinate, axiomatic kind of views. Okay, so this is what the partisan line of reasoning, the partisan habit of reasoning leads you to, you see. You have these commitments coming into the present sense, and now my present experience of talking to you or voting for someone is conditioned by that. Now, that's not a bad thing. You don't want to just randomly do new things every day just to be new. But the problem is, right, with any habit, is when it becomes inflexible and counterproductive. Okay? So when this habit starts constraining the way we interact with others, that's when it becomes problematic. It's what I call partisan perfect reasoning, because I like to give my argument the sheen of grammatical certainty. But no, the idea is that when partisans reason, and you see this on your Facebook feed or wherever, Twitter feed in an election year, partisans always have a way to look at the facts, and they perfectly come to the conclusion they held before they looked at the facts. You know, rarely does a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat look at the facts of the economy and say, my party is wrong. Or Republican look at the facts of the economy and say, you know what, you were right, I'm going to be a Democrat today. Okay, it always perfectly lines up in a predictable, mechanical way. So what does a partisan do, extreme partisan, when they reason? Well, they tend to only give hearings to their side, right? Main thing for me to do is post about the cool things I have to sell you, not the cool things you perhaps have to sell me. Another thing that lines up perfectly, think about it. You know, how many of your friends do you see argue like this? Their side has that monopoly on the good. The other side's full of evil. The other side's full of irrationality, allergies to facts and science or whatever you want to do. You know, this is one thing to always think about when you talk about communication. What image of the other person am I projecting? Would I like to have that image projected on me? You know, and so the partisan is very good at sounding like they have everything right and their opponents have everything wrong. That's going to be part of the problem to partisan reasoning. Also, partisans, and social science backs me up on this, smart partisans, like us in this room, highly intelligent people, score high on IQ tests, are great at finding counter objections, biases, problems with reasoning on the other side. But rarely are these partisans as enthusiastic about undermining their own position, you see. So it's, my position's perfect, but you're not thinking through your facts enough. Let's find 5 ways that could be a limited study you're drawing upon. Rarely do they have limitations on their own side, you see. Also, argument. How is argument looked at? Think about how we see political folks argue, right? Usually it's to beat up the other side. You know, it's to beat the other side into submission, or at least people that are watching. If I'm debating someone, I just need to do something to them enough such that you are persuaded I have the right and good on my side. So it's no longer this matter of openness to being wrong or change towards a better, more useful view. It's argument is war. You know, and that's, I think, a sad byproduct of the partisan mindset.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. Scott Stroud teaches pragmatism, philosophy, and communication at the University of Texas at Austin. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. If you're just joining us, today we're airing talks given last week at the University of Utah by both Scott Stroud and later in the program, Natalie Stroud, who are married and are both professors of communication at the University of Texas at Austin. They have both researched and written much about extreme partisanship and how media shape American political behaviors and attitudes. Again, this is Scott Stroud.
Now, why is this harmful? Well, it's harmful for, the way I cut it up, I say two different reasons. One, it seems like any conception of communication or rhetoric or how we ought to interact with other people is going to foreground some kind of notion of, we don't just communicate to show our perfection to the world. Oftentimes, we're communicating to be open to different ways of doing this. And that different way of doing this comes from you, right? So open to being wrong on certain positions, wrong with who I am, wrong with, big things I believe in the world, like religion, feminism, men's rights, whatever view you really subscribed to a second ago, ideally you should have some fallibilism in there, right, such that you could correct that or totally abandon it even if it turns out to be, justified. So this is kind of the notion of, self-improvement. But a partisan, if you're already right, why interact with people? Well, partisans know why they interact with people, to win, to beat them up, to shut them up. They're discursive obstacles, you see. So this, I think, is treason to the notion of communication and democracy. How do I get along with you and improve myself and what I take is true or good if I have this hardened mindset? The second one is social, you see. And we see this in politics in the U.S., right? The more you are a partisan in the extreme form, the more you create other partisans on the other side. So you should not be shocked that if your view of argument is zero sum creates people who view you as an enemy or an obstacle to shut up to. So this is just going to create more of a zero-sum, very hostile, very aggressive conflict. Think about when we talk to people, whether it's in Washington, whether it's here at the State House, or whether it's, you and your family trying to decide up who gets the car for the weekend. You got a problem. You need to solve that problem. But in solving or resolving that problem, you do certain things that are going to affect people in the future, right? The relationships you have with these people, that'd be the way I'd really point to this. So think about it this way. Sometimes in Washington, you can win a vote, destroy a filibuster, use a filibuster to destroy someone. But what do? You create people who want to filibuster you or destroy your policy 2 weeks down the road. So this is something that you need to be attentive to if you take democracy as a way of life. In solving our problems now, do I create the conditions to solve future problems in the future? Because I have to live with these people. Democrats have to live with Republicans. Republicans have to live with Democrats. Green Party or whatever natural law party has to live with all of them. We all have to live with each other. And this is what I think the pragmatist view starts to foreground. Yet when you think in a hardened partisan way, you may win today, but you set up the conditions to lose tomorrow. Now, the path of skepticism, I'll just briefly go over this. The path of skepticism says, there's always a risk that when I think I'm being open, I'm really just fooling myself. So the way to solve this, right, is be skeptical of all claims. So a skeptic, cynicism is kind of a version of this, but a skeptic in the philosophical sense is someone who says no claim that says it's true is going to be true. So all claims are false. Now that's interesting, right? Maybe some of your friends are like this. Everything you say, they are contrarian to it. Now you go back to your dorm rooms or wherever your office is and say you're a skeptic. Okay. Now, the problem with skepticism is, and in communication, you get a variety of forms of this. Okay, Richard Rorty has a form. Raimi Macaro has a form of critical rhetoric where you're always undercutting things people take to be true. But I want to note, and I'll end on this point, there are two problems with skepticism, you see. One is an issue of why bother? If everything is probably false, why do anything? Why vote? Why argue with people? Why try to figure out the best policy, the true thing to believe on something? So this is a classical problem with skepticism. The other one is a problem that pragmatism, in the form I've been telling you about, highlights, okay, which is going to be a matter of respect. That's what I would call it. If I say, look, you only believe that because your parents took you into a certain church building early on, or you only believe that about Obama or Boehner because of sexism, racism, insert some kind of ideological explanation for why they uttered those words. These people are not likely to love that. They're not likely to respect you. They're not likely to feel that. They feel like they're an object being shoved around in the world, and you're a rational thinker uttering truths. Okay? Whereas in real communication, we ought to both treat each other the same way. So it's a matter of respect, and the skeptic, I think, erodes that respect. The other solution, which I'm going to leave you with today, is an intriguing one. It's called pluralism. So skeptic says all views are most likely false. Partisan says, I'll just find the true views, right? But then it always happens they find the true views they already believed in or their party told them to believe. The pluralist is an interesting alternative. The pluralist is going to say, every view most likely has some grasp of the truth. Like in India, you have the seven blind men touching the elephant in different parts and saying the elephant is this and that. And then, you know, someone with sight comes along and says you all are describing just a part of the same truth of the elephant. This is a classical Jain proverb of, you know, perspectival truth, pluralism. Everyone was getting a part of it. You went wrong when you said, I have the only part of what the elephant's like. Okay? So this, I think, is an interesting, point. I've written a touch on this in other places in regards to some philosophical traditions, but it's interesting. How do we become a pluralist and not be just a mere relativist? You know, be back to the anything goes, why bother problem with skepticism. I think pluralism is a way to respect other people because you automatically start arguing from the position they have most likely a reasonable, charitable position, whereas a partisan most often will be like, I already figured out the right stuff. This fool is ignorant or evil, trying to fool me. Okay, so now the question becomes, how do we inculcate this? Typical critical thinking says just look for the true arguments, watch for bias. But I've already talked about some of the problems with that. They probably tend to end up where you began. So this is a real question. How do we get ourselves out of partisan perfect reasoning? It's tough, but you know, life's not supposed to be easy.
That's Scott Stroud, professor of communication studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Next, Natalie Jomini Stroud is the author of Niche News, The Politics of News Choice, published in 2011. Her book explores the causes, consequences, and prevalence of partisan selective exposure and the preference for like-minded political information. Her research at the University of Texas at Austin on selective exposure, the idea that people tend to favor information which reinforces pre-existing views and avoid contradictory information, has received wide recognition and numerous awards. Both Scott Stroud and Natalie Stroud, who are married, spoke last week on November 7th at the University of Utah.
Well, what a great way to start. And we have, Scott and I have so many things in common in terms of how we approach the partisan world, but our methodological orientation is quite different, as you'll see. And as I pull this up here, let me just say thanks from both of us to the Department of Communication and the Hinckley Institute for having us today. We're just delighted to be here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this approach of partisanship and what it means and where we're going with it, and I'm going to really focus on the media and how partisans consume media and what is a consequence of people consuming media based on their partisanship. So to start with, here's just the basic TV guide that you would have encountered a couple of decades back. You went home after a long day, it's 5 p.m., you sat down and you wanted to watch TV. Well, truly, your only options would be 3 nightly national news programs. That would be it. So this would be your choice set. You'd pick something. And if we think about how things have changed today, it's unbelievable, right? So let's assume you go home, but you want to watch news. So you're still a news consumer. You go home, and now all of a sudden you have so many more options. You don't have to watch one of those nightly national news programs. You can watch many, many other things. So just show of hands, how many of you would choose to watch something on this slide rather than the nightly national news broadcast on the previous one? How many would watch something here instead? Nice and high, nice and high. I would say maybe 40 to 50% of you would make a selection on this slide. And this, to me, really showcases what has dramatically changed about the media environment. No longer are we turning to these really stalwarts of the media world. Let's go to these classic folks that are reporting the news. Now we're looking at many different media outlets, several of which have partisan agendas. So that's going to be what I'll talk about today. I have 4 questions for us that I'll cover in my talk today. The first is, what influences where we turn for news and information? The second is, why does the public make specific news choices? The third is, what is the effect of where people turn for news? And the fourth is where my recent research has been, which is, what do we do about this? The other professor, Stroud, gave you a lot of the problems that are happening right now. How can we fix this? So we'll turn there last. So first one first, what influences where the public turns for news? Well, the theoretical approach that I take for looking at this is a concept known as selective exposure. And selective exposure is the idea that we're motivated to look for information that matches our beliefs and to avoid information that might contradict our beliefs. And this is a theory that's been around for a long, long time. This is not something that I came up with. It's been around since the 1950s. And the thing that is supremely interesting about this theory is that there's such a history of conflicting research findings. So if you go back to the research in the 1960s and plow through it, you will have some people that say, oh, this happens all the time. And you'll have some people that say, no, we don't look at information that matches what we believe. That's not how this works. The thing that's even more crazy, though, is if you look at research literature in the early 2000s, it's just as divided. So people today are still arguing over whether or not this happens. And so when I first encountered this research literature, I thought, what is going on here? Why is it that we can't come to agreement about whether we look for like-minded information or not? And I have two proposals for you for why that has happened. The first is, if you go back to that early literature, and even some of the contemporary literature, they look at our motivation to look at like-minded information for some things like products. So there are studies out there that say, if you have a certain mascara brand preference, are you willing to look in an ad for another mascara brand? And that, to me, is really, really, really different from a study that focuses on politics. Are you likely to look at a Democrat or a Republican perspective if you have a different partisanship? Partisanship is something that's deeply ingrained, as the other Professor Stroud just talked about. It's something that really motivates us. Maybe for some people out there, mascara does too. I don't want to wall that off. But for most people, partisanship is so much more a part of their self-identity than the mascara choice. So I think first we have to separate these. And indeed, if you do, if you put a pile of research together of here's all the research on products, and here's a pile of all the research on politics, there's a lot more evidence that we look for like-minded information based on politics than all this other stuff. Second is, we have to really look at the type of exposure that's of interest to us. Are we curious about what people just do one time on a random Saturday? Or do we want to know habitually, where do people turn for news and information? And I argue we want to know the latter. Where do people tend to go for news and information? Not one-time sort of exposure, but the places that they continually return to find out what's happening in the political world. So these are my two points. And so with this, I said, let's do some analysis. And so I had the wonderful opportunity to be part of this survey called the National Annenberg Election Survey. And they surveyed over 30,000 Americans. And so I had data from 30,000 Americans that told me what newspapers they read, what radio programs they listened to, what websites they accessed. And so I went through all of these data, you can imagine the task that this was, and coded it. Does it lean left? Does it lean right? Or can I really not make a determination? And then I looked at what people said their partisanship was. Were they identifying as Democrats or Republicans? And then what did they use? And the pattern is really, really clear. So Scott previewed for you, I'm kind of a math person, so I'm going to show you a couple of charts on this, but we'll break them down so they're super easy. Okay, so first we looked at what newspaper did people read. Red here is indicating conservatives and Republicans. Blue here is indicating liberals and Democrats. So if you look at Republican endorsing newspapers, Republicans are more likely to read them. If you look at Democrat endorsing newspapers, Democrats are more likely to read them. And this pattern is going to become really familiar, so much so that I can flip past it pretty quickly and you're going to say, oh yeah, that same thing keeps appearing over and over again. Here's what the pattern looks like when we turn to radio. Conservative radio predominantly populated in the audience by those people who have conservative or Republican leanings. Vice versa for liberal radio. Cable news patterns, Fox News attracts conservatives and Republicans. CNN and MSNBC tend to attract more Democrats and liberals. Internet, huge differences here in terms of people's probability of looking at media that match their partisanship. So, big conclusion here, there seems to be something about people's partisan identity that motivates where they turn for news and information, and it happens regardless of what media type we're looking at. Okay, so some of you may be skeptics about this. You may say, yeah, I see how that's working, but I'm not totally convinced because it's just a survey. Maybe people were lying. Who knows what all happened during that? So I did another study, and it's one of my favorite studies I have done, and I call it the magazine study. And this was to try to capture people's behavior in the real world. And so here's what happened. People came to a university library, and we had them come in, and we said, oh, thank you so much for showing up to the study. We really appreciate it. Unfortunately, our study is running just a few minutes behind. Would you mind waiting in the waiting room for just a little while we get everything set up? And everyone's so nice. Oh, yes, of course. We'd love to do that. And so they sat in a waiting room, much like this one, and lo and behold, on the table next to them, a series of political magazines that were from very different political viewpoints, and an undergraduate research assistant whose summer job was to pretend to be studying, but actually what he was doing was watching what magazines people picked up and recording how much time they spent with each magazine that they had there. So we did this. So after about 5 minutes, the other researcher came out and said, oh, we're ready for you now. And the person went in and participated in another study. So there actually was another study. And at the end of that other study, they said, oh, thank you again so much. We would love to give you a subscription to a magazine. And lo and behold, the same magazines appeared. And we actually did give them a subscription to a political magazine. But the whole reason to do all of this is to say, in their natural environment, do people pick magazines that match their political beliefs? And guess what? Yes, they do. There's something about partisanship that even in a waiting room or in a subscription decision after they participate in the study, they pick things that match their partisan identities. So first question here, what influences where the public turns for news? Well, by and large, our answer here is partisanship.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. We're now going to continue with a talk from last week given by Natalie Stroud, professor of communication studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She spoke about what researchers have learned about how political partisanship is formed and how people tend to favor news media, which reinforces pre-existing views.
So why does the public do this? Why do we use partisanship as a criterion for our news selection? Well, there's a really interesting theory, and in fact, Professor Koh has done some excellent work in this area, so if you have more questions, I would urge you to chat with him about this. But it's called the hostile media effect. Show of hands, anyone familiar with this theory? Oh, thank you, Professor Koh, for raising your hand. We are thrilled that... This is a really interesting theory because it explains why this happens. So let's say for a moment that I can just erase partisanship from all of your minds. I have like some magic wand or something, and we get rid of partisanship. And we all find this media article, and we all say to ourselves, that's neutral. We all agree that's neutral. Well, the truth of the matter is that we all have partisan identities. And when we have that article that seems to be neutral, those people on the political right will read it and say, oh my gosh, that's biased in favor of the political left. But those people on the political left will read exactly the same article and believe it is biased in favor of the political right. So the weird thing that we find with when people process media is that a neutral media outlet is seen as biased by people on both sides of the political aisle, which is really bad news for the media that's trying to be objective, right? Because a great day for them means people on both sides of the aisle aren't very happy with you. But you might say to yourself, okay, you've been talking, though, a lot about biased media. A lot of media out there does have a certain slant to it. Well, it turns out that the hostile media effect generalizes to those cases in a very interesting way. So let's say we have a democratically leaning article. It actually leans Democrat. If you're a Republican reading that article, what do you think? What do you think about the bias of that article? It's truly, it leans a little bit to the left. If you're a Republican reading it, what do you think? Super far left. Oh my gosh, this thing is totally biased. This is the craziest thing I've read. If you're a nonpartisan, you'll probably read it and say, yeah, there's a little bit of bias here, but it's not too bad, just a little bit. But the weird part is, for some articles, if you're a Democrat, reading that democratically leaning article, in some instances, you will say to yourself, oh, great, finally, unbiased news. This is the best thing I've read. And so you find these patterns where Democrats and Republicans will read an article that slants in their favor and will actually believe that that article is unbiased reporting. Now, it doesn't happen all of the time. When articles are truly over the top, even people that share that political identity will then say, yeah, yeah, that leans in my favor. But there's this sweet spot where people will say biased news is, in fact, not biased to them at all. And so this is why we would consume like-minded media, because it seems really trustworthy. It seems like the really good stuff. So we're psychologically hardwired in some way to do this sort of behavior of looking at like-minded media. I also would argue to you that the public is, in fact, taught to look at like-minded media. And we're taught this day in and day out. First, we're taught it by the media. So the media, in fact, tell us, use partisanship as a criterion for your news decisions. I have two examples here. Bill Press Show says, the new liberal way to start your day. Clearly, he is telling you what is appropriate for that audience. Another example, Kimmer Show. Get your daily dose of unapologetic, America-loving, wussy liberal blasting, hard news, and ever so slightly biased commentary here. Again, it's pretty clear that partisanship is a component of the decision that you should make when deciding whether or not the Kimmer Show is for you. But it's not just media outlets that do this. Political leaders themselves actually educate us in a certain way about what outlets we should consume on the basis of our partisanship. Examples here, Dick Cheney has called out the New York Times for making the job of defending the country against terrorism more difficult. So if you like Dick Cheney and he says, New York Times is making the job of defending against terrorism more difficult, are you really going to read the New York Times? In addition, Barack Obama in the third presidential debate in 2008 calls out the Chicago Tribune as a Republican-leaning newspaper. Again, sending cues. Partisanship is appropriate. And depending on your partisan identity, this is where you should go. So my answer to the second question, before I get there, additional things. We find out how to consume media, even in pop culture. So if you're a rap fan, Nas actually will tell you that Fox News is feeding you toxins. So you learn from Nas what media outlet you should consume. Not to be outdone, Hank Williams Jr. also tells us the left-wing liberal media are no good. But it goes deeper than this. Vogue magazine, there are clearly defined outlets on the left and the right, Fox News and MSNBC. Even in fiction, you start to see these differences. So Jodi Picoult's novel, you can tell a lot about people's habits. There are those who watch CNN and those who watch Fox. So it's just everywhere that we get these messages about partisanship. So why does the public make specific news choices? One, they're psychologically inclined. This is the hostile media effect. And two, we're taught to do this. All of the time we see it in mainstream media that partisanship is the criterion we should use for our news selection decisions. Okay, third one, what is the effect of where we turn for news and information? When people look at news and information that matches their beliefs, it actually affects their political attitudes and behaviors. So as a consequence of looking at political media that matches your beliefs, you tend to develop more politically polarized attitudes. So you start to think, hey, my side is really right, and that other side is really wrong. And if you've ever watched a Rachel Maddow or a Bill O'Reilly, it's clear why that's the case, right? They tell you over and over again why that side is right and the other side is wrong, and you start to believe that. In addition to this, and to be fair and balanced, pardon that, but it's not the case that partisan selective exposure is always bad. So yes, it creates more polarized citizens, but at the same time, it energizes people and increases rates of political participation. People who watch like-minded news media tend to vote more. They tend to get involved in politics more. And this makes sense too, right? You watch these programs or listen to them, and afterward you think, oh my goodness, I had better get out there because if that other side wins, this is really, really bad news. So the effects of where the public turn out for news are both democratically encouraging and discouraging. From an encouraging side, it increases political participation. If we really want a very participatory citizenry, we should force people to watch partisan news all the time. It would have a wonderful effect. But it has this democratically discouraging component as well, which is that it makes people polarized. It makes their attitudes more favorable toward their own side and makes them really not like that other side. So I would say to you, if everyone were using partisan news, I would be nervous. I would be nervous that we have people who are really polarized who aren't willing to listen to views unlike their own, which is what leads me to my final question for you, which is, what do we do about this? We have these partisan habits that the other Professor Stroud talked about, as did I. How can we fix this in any meaningful way? So the most common suggestion is we should just tell everyone to watch both sides. So everyone, you should watch the really liberal stuff and watch the really conservative stuff. My favorite quotation here is from New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof, who talks about this. And he says, what's the solution? Tax breaks for liberals who watch Bill O'Reilly or conservatives who watch Keith Olbermann? know until President Obama brings us universal health care, we can't risk the surge in heart attacks. So perhaps the only way forward is for each of us to struggle on our own, to work out intellectually with sparring partners whose views we deplore. Think of it as a daily mental workout analogous to a trip to the gym. If you don't work up a sweat, it doesn't count. Now excuse me while I go and read the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. So a few things to notice about this. First, he's doing the exact thing I told you about just a moment ago, where he's educating you on what media you should use based on your partisanship. And the second is, think about it really. Think about one of your hardcore partisan friends or family members. Think about what would really happen if that person flipped over either to Fox News or MSNBC tonight. Do you think they would come away from that experience saying, you know what? That other side really has some stuff to share, and I think they're onto something. Or do you think they would come away saying, wow, they are crazy, and now I have confirmed it because I saw the other side? I argue to you that the latter would happen, so I say by itself, this is really unlikely to work. This is not a solution that is going to work. So another idea is, well, maybe it's just educating people. I'm a faculty member at the University of Texas at Austin. Wouldn't it be great if educated people would stop doing this? They would say, oh, let me look at both sides. I'll be more reasonable. And we would just get people to be more educated, and it would solve this problem. So I was in my office running this analysis. I had my laptop up in front of me, and I was so excited because I was like, this is it. It's knowledge. That's going to solve this. And the sad, sad finding is that it was totally not correct. Knowledgeable people are worse at every single part of this. They are more likely to believe there are biases against them. They are more likely to look like-minded news and information. So this is, again, not the solution. Okay, another idea. What if we took inspiration from the critical thinking world and we actually told people to use their critical thinking skills really carefully and look for signs of bias? So if we told half of you to look for signs of bias and half of you not to, would those of you who we told to look for signs of bias be better about it? Again, really sad news. That critical thinking tenet of look for signs of bias doesn't seem to help. And if anything, it makes things worse. So that didn't work. Another idea. Okay, what if we make things comedic and funny? Then will people look at the other side because it's in a funny format? Maybe if we give political information in this format, they'll be more likely to look at different views. So I did a big experiment. I had other students write the funny parts. It turns out academics aren't quite so funny, but it worked out well. We did this huge experiment, and I was wrong again. Comedy, in fact, seemed to intensify these behaviors again. People were more likely to look at comedic information that matched their beliefs, and they were more likely to develop intolerant attitudes toward other people. So, wrong again. The most recent thing I've been looking at, and I'm pleased that I get to end on a more positive note of something that actually worked after a lot of these depressing ideas that didn't work, is an engaging news project, which is where we're working with newsrooms to try to figure out what they can do on their sites to try to encourage people to think across the political aisle. So one of the studies that we've done is we've been looking at what happens online when we look at the buttons that are used in comment section, which seems like such a small thing, right? But the like button is something that's used really frequently in these comment sections. And it got us thinking, does that button have any sort of meaning? There's a literature on this, actually, which is pretty amazing. And it's this model called the stereotype content model. And what this argues is that we evaluate people first on whether we like or dislike them. So we have this one way we judge people. And then we also judge people on whether we respect them or don't respect them. And these are actually distinct dimensions. So some people we like and respect. Some people we like, but we disrespect. Some people we respect but dislike. So as an example, we tend to dislike but respect rich people. We don't like them, but we kind of respect them. I mean, they did something great to get their wealth, right? We also find, according to this model, that liking is connected to competition. So when we use the word like, we're triggering partisan ways of thinking about the world. So what we did is we did a study where we gave people the identical comment section. For a third of them, we gave them the like button. A third of them, we gave them a recommend button. And a third of them, we gave them a respect button. And what we wanted to know is, can we change their behavior on the basis of what button was there? We've done this twice on two different issues, and the result was so intriguing. What we found is that when we have the respect button there, people are more likely to respect a view they don't agree with politically, and they will not like it. So a Democrat is more likely to respect a Republican view, and they wouldn't like it as a consequence. Recommend was kind of in the middle between those two. But we think that building on this theory of the stereotype content model and doing subtle changes that newsrooms could easily implement, like putting a respect button there, maybe we could do a lot of things together to find out all of these small things that could help people appreciate different points of view and see past their partisan lens. So thank you so much for your time. Scott and I are delighted to be here and to take some of your questions.
Great, thank you very much, guys. That was fascinating. We're going to devote the remainder of time to questions from the audience. If you have a question, raise your hand. I'll bring you the mic, and just speak directly into the mic and give us your name and a little bit about yourself. Questions?
Hey, I was kind of curious, what do you think about like the hostile media? I guess this is more for you, Natalie. The hostile media analysis is it's applied to like the traditional media that's really struggling right now. I mean, are they in a position where they've been so long trying to be objective and neutral that in competition against these news sites that are engaging a particular audience that they're struggling because, like you show there, they're kind of pissing off people on both sides. They're not really making one side happy. Both kinds of people can read that kind of news and kind of walk away with it from it, not really feeling satisfied.
Oh, really great question. So I think that the market reasons are why we have partisan outlets and outlets targeting the middle, because when you have so many outlets competing, you have to differentiate yourself along some dimension, and partisanship turns out to be a really smart targeting strategy. So yes, did the middle lose some audience share to the sides? Yes, absolutely they did. Do I think that's why the middle, those outlets really focusing on objective journalism are struggling today? I actually don't think that's the reason. I think the big reason that we see outlets in the middle struggling right now is because of the switch to the internet. Because media outlets can't make the same money online that they can make offline. So they used to make tons of money offline from subscriptions and from classified ads. But now that we're moving online, revenues from advertising aren't there, and we don't have the subscription sort of models. Paywalls are kind of working for a couple of outlets, but not really for others. And I think that's a primary reason that we see them not doing quite as well. The other thing I will mention is, although research shows that people do tend to look at media matching their beliefs, it's not as though they never look at media on the other side or media in the middle. So it's not as though the pattern is so... It's not like an echo chamber where they never hear anything else ever, ever, ever. So I think that that's why that's not the primary cause of the middle doing poorly. I think it's the transition and the technology that's changed the media environment that has caused these shifts and tough times for objective news outlets.
Hi. Have you done a study to see like which side specifically respects the other one more? Like do Republicans respect Democrats more, or do Democrats respect Republicans more?
Love that question. Very, very pertinent question. In my research, I found that you find it on both sides. So both sides tend to look at media that match their beliefs. And in terms of that study where we were looking at the respect button versus the like button, in some instances, we see the political right shift and respect more. And in some instances, we see the political left shift and respect more. So that's actually something that I found really encouraging, because I think you can see those patterns on both sides. I would have been really worried if I only saw the pattern on one side. Good question.
With the second speaker, you discussed kind of like a paradigm of sorts with working with the news outlets, I believe, especially in the online context. My question would be, what hurdles do you anticipate? What hurdles do you anticipate that we might have to move over in order to reach that paradigm that you discussed? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
You'll give me feedback if I haven't answered it correctly. But I think the question is a little bit, how do we actually work with newsrooms to get them to institute some of these practices and things that we're suggesting? The way that we've approached that from the Engaging News Project is to try to look at these things not only from a democratic perspective, which is, look, the respect button leads people to click on comments that aren't like theirs, but we also look at it from a business angle. So are we seeing more clicks overall with the respect button? Well, maybe they could make a business case why this might be a good feature to include. Some of the other studies that we've done, we look at things like time on site, because as you get more time on site or more clicks, you can make a better case to advertisers for why they should advertise with you, which could have revenue implications. And so that's how we're trying to do it, is to say, newsrooms, look, there are two objectives that you have, business and democratic. Let's study both of them in concert, because that's your lived reality.
So I'd actually like to hear both of you comment on this one. So you kind of indicate that partisans are more likely to vote, and that's a kind of a positive thing about partisanship, if we might want to make that stretch. But might that actually be more of an implicate that voting is actually becoming a offshoot of partisanship rather than an actual enactment of a particular kind of democracy that we might actually hold on high, and particularly as the first speaker talked about, flexible, habitual democracy in terms of flexibility and making accounts and things like this. And how might that then implicate how we talk about the conflation of voting and democracy in our research?
Yeah, you know, this is probably one of the few areas we disagree other than violent movies to watch or something. But so you can tell she loves the Saw 5 or whatever. I was thinking that when you were going over that. I mean, from one perspective, it is a plus that partisans of that stripe vote more. On the other hand, I got thinking, like, well, that'd be like if I just recently got into trail running there in Princeton because there were finally nice weather, nice trails, and I was looking down so I don't trip over roots, and then all of a sudden next week, like, my stomach's about to fall off because I was bending over while I was running. So think about a bad habit of exercise posture that encourages you to go out and do something fun, but, you know, the ultimate, so I would worry that if we had 100% turnout and people were thinking in a very mechanistic way, that's like a lot of people going to the gym with bad posture, Now, that versus no one going to the gym, no one voting, you know, maybe then you say, well, I'd rather have the partisans. But a pragmatist, I try to split the middle and say, well, wait a minute, is there a better habit? Could we get 100% voting, 100% people running on trails, looking a little bit farther ahead with better posture? You know, that's my take on it. But it's tricky. You know, I don't think a democracy is great if no one cares about voting.
And I come at it for more of a quantitative side, which is empirically we know that voters today are more partisan than they used to be. And the middle is not turning out in a way that they once did. And so when that's the case, then it is becoming a partisan action of going to the polls and voting. And there are a number of experiments that actually took place in 2014, just this past week, trying to find out, are there methods to encourage those in the middle to turn out to vote? So we'll see what the results of those are. But I agree with your proposition that voting and partisanship have become increasingly intertwined.
Since I probably won't see you again, do you think there's much of a middle left?
I think it exists, but I don't think they turn out to the same degree.
Yeah, I'm going to go along with this young lady's question. She said, does Democrat respect Republicans more? Do you guys know the age group in your research? Do younger respect older and older young? Cause growing up, I've always had to respect the older because they're more knowledgeable. I don't necessarily like what they tell me to do, but I respect them definitely their views. Did you guys take that into account in your research?
So I would share a couple of anecdotes on that. So first, in the research on liking and respecting, not that I've done, but that others like Susan Fisk have done, they continually find that for the group that they identify as elderly, people do tend to have warm feelings for them and like them. But in fact, they're actually rated as less respected because they're seen as less competent. And so this is in general, this is asking lots of people lots of questions. That is the sad quadrant that they end up falling into. In terms of the behaviors of selective exposure, I have done analysis trying to find out if the patterns differ between younger and older, and I haven't found any evidence of that.
We have time for a couple more questions.
Got enough cable.
My name is Allison. I'm wondering if you've ever, either of you, come across a reluctant partisan who maybe is a family member that you think has got a political viewpoint but doesn't want to express it, and maybe how that would come out in the democratic process.
Yeah, I used to teach at a school long ago. It had a lot of people that were firm in their beliefs but didn't want to argue in class, so I called them lazy absolutists. You know? But, you know, they were right. They just don't care enough about you. But, yeah, I don't know. You know, they're not, if they're this is that's an interesting version. Is it as harmful of a habit of partisanship if I don't stick it, you know, out discursively and you know bang you over the head with it like a club? But I'm still just not open to change. You know, that might be a middle point. It's still not the democratic ideal, but maybe it's not as replicatively harmful. But I don't know. Most partisans I know, they love telling you and posting on Facebook that, you know, here's the truth. Be enlightened. I don't know.
I have a doctoral student right now who's looking at contexts in which people withhold their political views, and that happens very typically in situations in which you're surrounded by others that don't share your view, that people tend to fall silent. And she's been looking at the motivation, so why do people do that, and what strategies do they use in those situations? And it's pretty common that people want to protect the social fabric of their relationships, so they fall silent, or they change the subject, or they don't tell their full view. So that's maybe a situation in which that takes place and how people handle it. We do know from some research that Diana Mutz and others have done that when people are constantly around others that don't share their political identity, even though they have one, they start to fall silent even in terms of participating. So they're less likely to participate in politics.
Any further questions?
I was just curious if either of you know of trends like with newspapers or news channels becoming more or less partisan, or are they kind of staying like the same?
Oh, definitely your ball to hit out.
I mean, looking at recent times, if we just look at, you know, the past 50 years or so, the number of outlets that have partisan leanings has increased. But it's kind of a weird thing to say that, because if we go back to the very beginnings of the United States, the media were in fact rampantly partisan back then, and arguably even more so than now, because they were actually paid for by political parties. And if you read them back in the day, they were just horribly mean and using, you know, the swear words of the day to insult the other party. So if we take a long view, it's almost cyclical what we see happening right now, for different reasons, I would argue, today than they were back then. So it has increased in the short term, but it's returning in some ways to a past from long ago.
We have time for one more question.
Hey, my question is for both of you. So in regards to people who are maybe forming their partisanship, do you think people are just being like, oh, I've heard a lot about Fox, so I'll watch Fox, and then they form their partisanship based off of that? Or do you think people are going into it already being like, well, my parents are conservative, so maybe I'm going to give conservative media a shot. What do you think? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, it's a great question. We know that people form their political identities rather early in their lives, and family is a really important component of how they develop those identities. I would be really surprised of any research finding that said that, you know, kids randomly assigned, we put them to watch Fox and these other ones, MSNBC, and they develop different political identities. I don't think that that would quite be the case. But I will say that in some of my research, I've seen a bit of a spiral where people who tune into these partisan outlets then become more partisan, and then they're more likely to go back to these outlets. So then it intensifies a little bit. But the question is a little chicken and egg. It's more of this spiral process, I would argue.
Yeah, and leaving the facts aside, because that's her domain. I think it's a tragedy if someone forms a view because their parents have that view, and I think it's also a tragedy if they form a view because they want to do something different from their parents. Both of these are predictable and kind of mindless logics of, you know, forming something. And, you know, pragmatists talk about, you know, critical thinking as being intelligent, meaning you're going to be able to solve something now, you know, help you solve stuff in the future. So I think these kind of mechanistic ways, just rebelling from parents or just doing what you've always done, these are going to get you into trouble eventually. You're going to bump into people in society that don't have those views. You're not going to know how to interact productively. So that, I think, is the thing we ought to aim for. You know, how do you form things intelligently? It's easy for me to say that. It's tough for us to do that without being a hidden partisan, of course.
The Hinckley Institute Radio Hour was brought to you by the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah and KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss.